From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
Listen to me. You'll thank me later.
Better Call Saul, the Breaking Bad spinoff on AMC, begins season 2 on Monday. It's mostly a prequel set 6 years earlier. It explains how Saul Goodman became a fast-talking criminal lawyer and how Mike Ehrmantraut became a hitman. Today, we talk with Bob Odenkirk, who stars as Saul, and series co-creator Peter Gould, who also wrote for Breaking Bad, and Jonathan Banks, who plays Mike. In the prequel, Mike is working in a parking lot.
Peter comes to me and he goes, listen, I got this great idea. He's going to be in a parking booth.
We just had the image of the most badass guy we know doing the least likely thing. What the hell is he doing in that parking booth?
Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Deadpool based on the anti-hero Marvel comic book character. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Fresh Air TV critic David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross.
I know what you're thinking. Yeah, a lawsuit sounds good, Saul, but who can I sue? Who can you sue? Try police departments, libraries, construction companies, school officials, cleaning services, financial institutions, local and international.
That's an ad for Saul Goodman, the attorney, who took whatever work he could get from slip and fall cases and frivolous lawsuits to clients like meth cooker and dealer Walter White, the central character on the wonderful AMC series Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad is long gone now, but its legacy and some of its characters linger on in an AMC spin-off series called Better Call Saul, starring Bob Odenkirk. It's partly a sequel, but mostly a prequel, and tells the story of Jimmy McGill, the struggling attorney who would, in time, adopt the persona and the slippery morals of Saul Goodman. It also gives us the backstory of Mike Ehrmantraut, the hitman and fixer on Breaking Bad, and shows how Mike and Jimmy McGill came to work together. Breaking Bad was created by Vince Gilligan. Better Call Saul was co-created by Gilligan and Peter Gould, a Breaking Bad writer-producer who came up with the character of fast-talking Saul. Last year, when Better Call Saul premiered, it ended up at the very top of my annual 10 best list. Season 2 begins Monday on AMC, and the first two episodes I've seen are just as terrific as last year's. Later on the show, we'll listen back to Terry's interview with Bob Odenkirk, the star of Better Call Saul. But first, we'll hear her conversation from last year with Peter Gould, the co-creator of Better Call Saul, and Jonathan Banks, who plays the gruff and dangerous Mike Ehrmantraut. In last year's premiere episode of Better Call Saul, set 6 years before the start of Breaking Bad, Saul Goodman isn't using that name yet. He's still going by his birth name, Jimmy McGill. He's a public defender who's so broke, his home and office are in the back room of a nail salon. He's trying to get some wealthy, high-profile clients for his private practice. When he finds out that the county treasurer is suspected of having embezzled over $1.5 million, Jimmy, played by Bob Odenkirk, sets his sights on becoming the treasurer's lawyer. Jimmy can't invite clients to his shabby office, so he meets with the treasurer and the treasurer's wife in a restaurant.
Look, all I know is what I read in the paper. And typically, when money goes missing from the county treasury, and the number here is $1.6 million...
Well, that's an accounting discrepancy.
It's a discrepancy, absolutely. But typically, when that happens, the police look at the treasurer. And since that person is... I just think a little proactivity may be in order.
Yeah, well, I just think I'd look guilty if I hired a lawyer.
Actually, it's getting arrested that makes people look guilty, even the innocent ones. And innocent people get arrested every day. And they find themselves in a little room with a detective who acts like he's their best friend. Talk to me, he says. Help me clear this thing up. You don't need a lawyer. Only guilty people need lawyers. And boom, hey, that's when it all goes south. That's when you want someone in your corner, someone who will fight tooth and nail. Lawyers. We're like health insurance. You hope you never need it, but man, oh man, not having it? No.
Peter Gould, Jonathan Banks, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on Better Call Saul. Peter Gould, let me start with you. Of all the characters to spin off, why did you want to spin off a series about Saul?
It may sound like a calculated process, but there was nothing but organic instinct behind it. Saul Goodman was introduced in season 2 of Breaking Bad, and I was a little worried when he first appeared because he seemed maybe not in keeping with the rest of the tone of the show, but somehow he seemed to work in the world of Breaking Bad, and we loved him. Everybody in the writer's room enjoyed writing for him, and this character, he took us by the collar and said, do this show, more than us deciding that he was the guy.
So you had to figure out how to get into this prequel. So it starts in the present, where the character of Saul left off in Breaking Bad, and he's managing the Cinnabon in Omaha. He lives in a black and white world now. There's no glamour, he has no identity, he has no profile, and it's literally shot in black and white.
We really thought that we should see the consequences of all the fun. Jimmy McGill is a guy who makes a series of choices. Some of them are very understandable, and some of them are from his gut. And they lead to inexorably to one place, and that's the basement of the Disappearers. This is a guy who builds a character, Saul Goodman, and builds an empire of a kind, and then has it all pulled out from under him. And that is painful, and I think it also makes you wonder, what was it all about? What's the point of this guy's life? And I guess it's kind of a dark place to start with, but we thought it would make an interesting frame for the colorful, sometimes silly, sometimes intensely dramatic story of how he got to be the guy he is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Gould, who is the co-creator and co-showrunner of Better Call Saul, the new prequel from Breaking Bad. Peter Gould also wrote for Breaking Bad. Also with us is Jonathan Banks, who plays Mike Ehrmantraut, a character from Breaking Bad who returns for Better Call Saul. Let's play the very first scene that that the character of Mike Ehrmantraut is in. And Jesse's girlfriend, Jane, has OD'd in bed. Jesse wakes up to find her dead. He calls Walt. Walt calls Saul, the lawyer. And Saul sends Mike, the fixer. And Mike cleans up all the evidence of drugs and tells Jesse what to do. Here's the scene in which that happens.
Any other drugs in the house? Think hard. Your freedom depends on it. What about guns? You got any guns in the house? Here's your story. You woke up, you found her, that's all you know. Say it. Say it, please. I woke up, I found her, that's all I know. Say it. I woke up, I found her, that's all I know.
I woke up, I found her, that's all I know.
Again?
I woke up, I found her, that's all I know.
Again? Again?
I woke up, I found her, that's all I know. I woke up, I found her, that's all I know.
Once you call it in, the people who show up will be with the Office of Medical Investigations. That's primarily who you'll talk to. Police officers may arrive, they may not. Depends on how busy a morning they're having. Typically, ODs are not a high-priority call. There's nothing here to incriminate you, so I'd be amazed if you got placed under arrest. However, if you do, you say nothing. You tell them you just want your lawyer. Then you call Saul Goodman. Do I need to state the obvious? I was not here.
That's so great. And that's my guest, Jonathan Banks, as Mike Ehrmantraut. Jonathan Banks, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Terry.
So, you know, it was supposed to be Saul who cleans up things for Jesse and tells him what to say. So Peter Gould, it ended up being Mike. How did it end up being Mike?
Well, we were at the very end of season two, and there was this moment when Jesse woke up and Jane was dead. And we were going to have Saul Goodman come in and clean things up. And unfortunately, Bob was not available. Bob Odenkirk was not available to come to Albuquerque for that particular scene. And so very much at the last minute, Vince Gilligan had the inspiration of bringing in Mike, the fixer, or his private detective, who's been mentioned a couple of times on the show. And now we're going to see him. And through some miracle, we cast Mr. Jonathan Banks.
Jonathan Banks, what was the call? Did you get a call directly from Vince Gilligan?
No, they, Bialy Thomas, who are wonderful casting directors, I went in and I thought I was going to, you know, I thought I'd do a day's work and leave. and it snowed, and I went in, and that scene where you hear the slap is Aaron still complains about it. He didn't know it was coming. and I loved the boy, but you know, it was fun. I had a good time. And no, it came as a surprise. But you tell me if I'm wrong, Peter. But Peter and Tom Schnoz and Vince have been friends forever. And when they were kids in college, they used to watch Wise Guy. And so that, I guess my character on Wise Guy made an impression on them.
And Wise Guy was a great TV series that started in 1987 and introduced actors like Stanley Tucci and Kevin Spacey, at least that's where I found out about them. So you mentioned that Aaron Paul didn't know that you were going to slap him in that scene. Is that considered acceptable for you to do that?
It's totally acceptable for me. I'm not the one that got slapped.
The rules that apply to everybody else don't necessarily apply to Mr. Banks.
No, you know, I got that senior pass, you know. And so, you know, I mean, if you can't take a hit from an old guy, I mean, come on, Aaron can take a punch, for goodness sakes.
Better Call Saul co-star Jonathan Banks and co-creator Peter Gould speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2015 interview with Better Call Saul co-creator Peter Gould and co-star Jonathan Banks. Season 2 begins Monday.
I always wondered, like, how did Saul and Mike get to know each other? And we find out in Better Call Saul. Did we know that on Breaking Bad? Did we know how they knew each other?
Absolutely not.
Okay. I thought maybe I just
missed
it.
Mike was just conjured up when Saul Goodman needed him. Okay. Like a genie.
Okay. So we find out how they meet in Better Call Saul. And the answer is that Mike is working at the ticket booth of the parking lot that adjoins the courthouse where Saul is working as a public defender. And Saul is always, well, at this point is Jimmy. And Jimmy is always so just kind of in disarray that he never has time to get or the money to get the proper amount of like parking stickers on his sticker to not pay for the parking. So he's coming to the ticket booth at the parking lot, and at the ticket booth we hear a voice, and then we later see as the camera moves that it's Mike, that Mike we're going to get to see Mike again. Here's that scene. Jimmy's pulling out, stopping at the ticket booth and encountering Mike.
$3. I'm validated. See the stickers?
Well, I see 5 stickers. You're 1 shy. It's $3.
They gave me, look, I'm validated for the entire day, okay? 5 stickers, 6 stickers. I don't know from stickers because I was in that court back there saving people's lives, so.
Oh, gee, that's swell. And thank you for restoring my faith in the judicial system. Now, you either pay the $3 or you go back inside and you get an additional sticker.
Son of a bitch. Fine. You win. Hooray for you. Backing up! I have to back up! I need more stickers. Don't have enough stickers. Thank you. Thank you. Very nice.
Bob Odenkirk and my guest Jonathan Banks in the first episode of Better Call Saul. So Jonathan Banks, you're a former cop in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. You've played a lot of cops and former cops over the years. And in Wise Guy, where I first saw you, a TV series that started in 1987, you played the head of like an organized crime task force. And you were the supervisor for the Ken Walk character who goes undercover every week. So how did you get to play so many cops and former cops? Like, what is it about you, do you think,
I'm not very pretty, so I can't play the leading man. So I'm either going to be the bad guy or the cop. And that's, you know what? It's a smart aleck answer, but it's also, there's some truth in that in the world of Hollywood and television. If you're not beautiful, you better be able to act a little bit anyway.
Were you a tough guy at all as a young man?
No. I mean, these guys that get up and say, hey, I grew up in a tough neighborhood, it was this, it was that, it was that. The reality is they were sad neighborhoods. And if you were lucky enough to get out, oh, my gosh, how lucky I am. Yeah, and that's my answer.
I read your mother was in the CIA. Did you know exactly what she did, or was that like
my mom's gone now, but my mother started out in life on her own completely at 15 years old as a maid in a Methodist parsonage in Bloomington, Indiana. She was a whiz at shorthand and typing and da-da-da. They got her a job with the Navy Department in Washington, D.C. World War II came along. There was a period of time where she was Admiral Wilson's private secretary, Admiral Nimitz, at a brief time, who was a commander of the Pacific Fleet. After the war, she went to work, managed the secretarial pool, as I understood it, at the CIA, under a woman named Peggy Hunt. And back then, they would burn their carbons every day at the end of the day, and they had those oval back chairs that the secretaries would sit in. And she taught her girls, if someone came up behind them, that they were to throw their elbows straight back, stand up, and address them in a very loud voice. The thought being, if it went past that moment, that it was not going to go in their favor. They were secretaries, and whoever the man was that came up behind them was probably one of their superiors. Her bosses knew that that's what she taught, but that was pretty much the recourse that a woman had in the early 50s. There weren't any human resources to go to. And I mean this. I should be half the woman that my mother was.
It took me a while to realize you were talking about sexual harassment there.
Yep. Yeah.
And for people who don't know, when you said they burn their carbons, that's carbon paper that makes duplicates of what you're typing. Your mother must have typed a lot of secrets.
My mom, when the transcriptions came back from the Nuremberg trials, she was at the Treasury, and that's where the Secret Service used to be. And there was a tunnel that used to go under, and maybe it's probably still there, from the Treasury Department to the White House. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And as far as sexual harassment goes, she always left her office door wide open. And she raised me by herself.
So how did you get into acting?
I was a handful. And I used to, at the gym at the school, when I'd go out for whatever practice it was, I would look through the gym window, and I'd wanted to do it since I was probably five with Jimmy Durante and Jackie Gleason, who I just loved. And one day in the hall, Miss Cartwright, who did the plays, yelled at me when I was hanging with some of the boys. And she yelled down the hall and she said, Banks, you're a chicken. She said, I've seen you looking through that window for a long time. And she said, why don't you ever audition for a play? And I auditioned for the junior class play, and I got the lead, and we were doing Shaw's The Devil's Disciple, which no high school should ever do, but we did. And it changed my life. My mom was having to work all day long and go to school at night trying to give me a better life, but I was on the street a lot. And that answers some of your questions about the neighborhood or whatever it was. And, you know, when she got her teaching degree, and she then took me to this high school where I got very lucky. Hey, you know what I said, Terry, about being lucky? If I say it 1,000 times more, it's the way I feel. I honestly feel that I am one of the luckiest human beings that ever walked.
I love hearing stories about teachers who who give students an opportunity that they would have been too embarrassed or shy to ask for, or just wouldn't have thought of doing, and that it's transformative. So,
well,
I'll tell you this, that teacher.
It was one of those things, and then I did it. And of course, back then, you know, there were no computers. I thought there were only the smart kids did it, is what I thought, and I didn't think I belonged there. And they were all walking around with the slide rules in their pocket and all that, and they were so gentle with me, and they were so good to me because I was from somewhere else, I was from somewhere else, and they were dear to me. I look at those kids that, you know, back then were called nerds or whatever, and I couldn't have been treated any better. And there was a trade-off, too, because nobody was ever going to put them in a locker ever again, I can tell you that.
Were you going to protect them?
You bet you.
The roots of Mike. There we have it. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Peter Gould, co-creator of Better Call Saul, and the show's co-star, Jonathan Banks, speaking to Terry Gross last year. After a short break, we'll listen back to her 2013 interview with the show's star, Bob Odenkirk. We'll also hear film critic David Edelstein's review of the newest superhero movie, Deadpool. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Our Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CarMax, a nationwide retailer of used vehicles where people can buy or sell their car, offering written vehicle appraisals good for 7 days. Learn more at CarMax.com. CarMax, the bright side of car buying. And from the SciSims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a better life. More information is available at scisimsfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Seriously, when the going gets tough, you don't want a criminal lawyer, right? You want a criminal lawyer.
That's Aaron Paul as Jesse Pinkman in AMC's Breaking Bad, describing the character of Saul Goodman, the slippery lawyer played by our next guest, Bob Odenkirk. Breaking Bad creator Vince Gilligan and writer-producer Peter Gould enjoyed writing dialogue for that character so much, they spun him off into a series called Better Call Saul, which starts its second season on AMC on Monday. It's mostly a prequel to Breaking Bad, with Odenkirk as a low-rent defense attorney named Jimmy McGill before he came to adopt the swaggering, shifty persona of Saul Goodman. Terry Gross spoke with Bob Odenkirk in 2013. They began with his first appearance on Breaking Bad. It's from season two, when Walt and Jesse, played by series stars Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul, were still small-time meth cookers. The kid who was distributing their meth, Brandon Mayhew, a.k.a. Badger, was busted after selling to an undercover agent. In this scene, Badger is being interrogated at an Albuquerque police station when Saul shows up to represent him.
All right. Who do we have?
Brandon Mayhew.
Brandon Mayhew. All right. Brandon Mayhew. Ah, here we go. Public masturbation.
What?
I don't get it. What's the kick? Why don't you do it at home like the rest of us with a big flat screen TV, 50 channels of pay-per-view, in a Starbucks? That's nice.
That ain't me, man. I was the guy who was selling meth, allegedly.
Okay, all right, I got you. Meth, right. I'm sorry, that was a little transpositional error. Nothing little whiteout can't take care of. Yeah, and felony quantity.
Just barely.
Yeah, just barely. The cops around here are like butchers, always got their thumbs on the scales, you know. But good luck arguing that in court. Let me get down to brass tacks. I'm going to get you a second phone call, okay? You're going to call your mommy or your daddy or your parish priest or your Boy Scout leader, and they're going to deliver me a check for $4,650. I'm going to write that down on the back of my business card, okay? 4650, okay? And I need that in a cashier's check or a money order, doesn't matter. Actually, I want it in a money order. And make it out to Ice Station Zebra Associates. That's my loan out. It's totally legit. It's done just for tax purposes. And after that, we can discuss Visa or MasterCard, but definitely not American Express. So don't even ask, all right? Any questions?
What a great start for your character, Bob Odenkirk. Welcome to Fresh Air. What did you know about your character, Saul, when you took the role?
Well, I got a phone call, and my agent said they're going to offer you a role, and you should say yes to this one. And it wasn't like I had been saying no to a lot of roles, but I guess I do say no, maybe more than a few other people. So I said, okay, well, what is it? And he said it's on Breaking Bad. And at the time, the series was in its second season. It was to appear in the last four episodes of the show. I talked to Vince, and Vince said,
"This is Vince Gilligan, the creator."
Vince Gilligan, the creator. I said, "Let me just talk to him." And he goes, "He's a sleazy lawyer. His name's Saul Goodman." And I go, "Well, you know, I'm not Jewish." I said, "There's a lot of Jewish actors. I'm sure you could find one." And he goes, "Oh no, no, he's not Jewish. He's Irish. he just changed his name to appeal to the homeboys and gain some stature in their eyes."
You've said that you based Saul on Hollywood agents more so than on lawyers.
Yeah, I don't know any lawyers.
So what kind of agents do you know who are anything like Saul?
Oh, my God. A lot of them.
Really?
Yeah. They talk really fast. You know, the character wants to get something out of whoever he's talking to. He's trying to manipulate them into doing what he wants. And I think that's true for a lot of agents, is they're aware of a certain scenario that they can sell, you know? When they're talking to you, they're pitching you in a clever way on just fitting into a business proposition that they know for some reason that they can sell, you know, to make deals.
And of course, you played an agent on Gary Shandling's show. And you used some similar tactics.
Yeah, my first agent is the great Ari Emanuel, who now runs William Morris.
Oh, and he was the basis for, what's his name's character?
Ari Gold.
Yeah, on Entourage. So he was your first agent?
Yes, and he was my basis for my character on Larry Sanders, Stevie Grant.
Oh.
So Ari's inspired a lot of performances.
Wait. So does this mean that Saul Goodman, the lawyer on Breaking Bad, is kind of 6 degrees of separation from Ari Emanuel? Yeah, really?
Absolutely.
Does Ari Emanuel know that? Does Ari Emanuel's clients know that?
I hope he'd be proud of it. I think he would be proud of it. He likes being noticed, and I think he gets a kick out of his people's estimations of his various talents. He's a great guy. I really like that guy a lot. Also, if I might add, I did an impersonation of Robert Evans, the great film producer, who is such an entertaining guy to hear talk. You know, if you've ever heard his book on tape, The Kid Stays in the Picture, it's incredibly entertaining. And when I saw how many lines I had as Saul, which is a lot more than comedy. In comedy, you'll get like two lines, and then it's a more of a back and forth usually. And Saul Goodman has these long monologues.
Oh, because he's a talker.
He really is a talker. And what he's doing is he's trying to convince you of something. And when he sees that it's not working, he goes another route. Like he switches it up in midstream until he finds the tack that will get him where he wants to go. And when I saw those longs, I thought, you know, I wish I could do some kind of Robert Evans-y type voice with a little melody in it and a little in that kind of stop and start cliffhanger thing that Robert Evans does when he goes, you know, did I do the right thing? Heck no. Would I do it again? In a second. You know, he leaves you hanging there for just a hair, and it makes you makes you listen even closer, you know? And so I thought I'd steal some of that. I don't know how much I did, but I do the character as Robert Evans as practice, and then I just do it when I get on stage, or in front of the camera, I mean.
I think I have the perfect scene here to illustrate what you just said about Saul, about how he's not selling it one way. He's going to change directions and just try something else. And this is a scene from season 2, episode 8, where Saul's been representing the guy who's been dealing meth for Walt and Jesse, the guy who we heard in the first scene. And Walt and Jesse are really afraid that you're going to let your client talk to the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And if he talks, that's going to out Jesse and Walt, and they're going to be in prison. So they can't allow that to happen. So what they've done is they've basically kidnapped you, taken out to the desert. They've dug you a grave, and they're making you kneel, staring into this grave that they've made for you. Meanwhile, they're standing behind you with ski masks on their faces so you can't tell who they are, and they have guns pointed at your back. You have no idea who they are or what they want or why they've captured you. You suspect that they're representatives of one of the Latin drug cartels. Here's the scene. You speak, or shall I say, whimper first, begging for your life.
What can I do for you, gentlemen? Anything, just tell me what you need.
This afternoon, an associate of ours offered you $10,000. You should have taken it.
Wait a minute, this is in regards to what's his name?
Badger, Brandon Mayhew.
The uncle, that was your guy? No offense, guys, but I don't take bribes from strangers. You know, better safe than sorry. That's my motto. But I'll take your money, sure.
Nah, that offer's expired, yo.
Oh, it was kind of low anyways. But okay, I'll take it. Just tell me what you need, all right? I'm easy. I'm going to keep a happy thought and assume this is just a negotiating tactic.
All right. Listen to me very carefully. You're going to give Badger Mayhew the best legal representation ever. But no deals with the DEA. All right? Badger will not identify anyone to anybody. If he does, you're dead.
Why don't you just kill Badger? I mean, follow me, guys, but mosquitoes buzzing around you bite you on the ass. You don't go gunning for the mosquito's attorney. You go grab a fly swatter, I mean, so to speak. I mean, all due respect, but do I have to spell this out for you?
We're not killing Badger, yo!
What a great scene. And so my guest Bob Odenkirk as the lawyer Saul, with Aaron Paul as Jesse and Bryan Cranston as Walt in season 2 from Breaking Bad. And this is how you become their lawyer, because you realize like the way to play this is to tell them, like, you have to tell me everything. I'll help you, but first you have to make me your lawyer by officially paying me. So just, like, put a dollar in my pocket. I'm your lawyer. Now we have attorney-client privilege. You can say anything, and I'm going to help you, and you don't have to kill me. So
yeah,
brilliant strategy.
Great, fun scene. We were in the desert at 2 a.m. in a sandstorm in the middle of nowhere. It was freezing, too. It was like 40 degrees.
Which is good, because you should be shaking with fear. So.
Yeah, it was quite an experience and made me happy to be in show business.
So the writing is so good on Breaking Bad. And like with your character, with Saul, there's something so not only kind of like comic and wordy, but almost flowery about the way he speaks. Like he has his guns pointed at his back. He's overlooking his grave in the scene that we just heard. And he's calling them gentlemen. Like, like Walt and Jesse who have guns on him. And he's saying, like, with all due respect. Do you love the kind of almost like old-fashioned flowery way he has of speaking?
I do. I do. It's fun to talk like that. It's fun to have a character who's that verbose. And believe me, when I got the first script and there were these long speeches, and I thought, just coming from comedy, I thought, well, when they rewrite the speech, you know, the final draft is going to be just a short line. It'll just be a line saying, I can't help you, you know? And then I got the rewrites, the blue pages, because they're printed on blue paper, about 5 days before I shot the first scene. And literally one word had been changed in all those speeches. And it made me go, okay, well, now what's really going on here? Why did the writers think that my character needs to talk this much? And then that's when I started taking apart those speeches and seeing that there's often a line of logic that Saul is following, and then he's finding it a dead end, and he has to go another direction. So it's all about manipulating the person he's talking to.
Bob Odenkirk, star of AMC's Better Call Saul, speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, with live coaching, email marketing features such as drag-and-drop editing, and social media tools. Constant Contact is committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits become marketers. More at ConstantContact.com. And from Visit St. Petersburg Clearwater, offering 35 miles of white sand Florida Gulf beaches, and St. Pete's Dolly Museum, presenting Disney and Dolly, Architects of the Imagination, now through June 12th at visitstpeteclearwater.com.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with Bob Odenkirk, star of the AMC series Better Call Saul. Season 2 begins Monday.
Tell us something about your childhood, where you grew up, what you were known for among friends in school.
Well, I am from Naperville, Illinois, and from a family of 7 kids. And they're a funny group of people. All of them are funny. My brother Bill is a writer of The Simpsons. He's been for about 10 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we were far away from the world of show business in Naperville. And so it took me a long time to imagine even that I could be a part of this. But it's a very funny group of people. And there was a lot of good times and a lot of laughter in our house, and a lot of impersonations of people that we'd met that day. And it's a mostly Irish, some German Catholic family. And my mother is very funny, though she doesn't really know it. She's makes a lot of wisecracks all through her day, and she laughs a lot. And my father was kind of a good joker, too, although he liked to tell, like, bar jokes. And when I was young, he liked hee-haw, which escaped me.
Did he actually, like, tell jokes?
Yeah, he told jokes, you know, like you pick up in a bar.
Yeah, do you remember any of the jokes he told?
I don't. I never liked them. I never liked the jokes. My dad, I didn't like that much either, but I tolerated him.
So when you became a comic, having had your father tell a lot of jokes, but not,
yeah.
but you not liking
but not
joke
my kind
jokes.
Of jokes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so what did that make you want to turn to when you become a comic?
Well, nothing consciously. It's just I just did what I did. I didn't think about that, except I always felt like comedy was about honesty, you know, and somehow saying how you really feel about things, you know, because for me, it's about getting to the core of things and speaking honestly about hypocrisy and stuff. But there was a kind of comedy I saw a lot of when I was a kid that was almost the opposite. It was like this strange kind of covering up of genuine motivation. All those Bob Hope specials just made me cringe when I was a kid. You never found them funny, and all the sexual innuendo just made me crazy, even though as a child I didn't know what sex was about, but I just remember watching and thinking, why don't you just say you're horny, you know, instead of rolling your eyes? What a weird thing. We all know what you mean. You know, it just seemed dishonest in a strange way, and I didn't know why anyone would find it funny. When I found Monty Python, that's what really spoke to me.
People like your character so much that you were on a recent cover of The New Republic. And the cover was for a story about how big law firms are having a hard time making big money now. And so there's a picture of you on the cover in your full Saul Goodman persona. And the caption reads, "Are you downwardly mobile, terrified of your colleagues, unsure of what your kids look like, realizing that after selling your soul for the promise of a cushy life, your whole field is going to hell? You must be an attorney." I'm wondering if you get a lot of reactions to Saul from lawyers, if they like your character or if they're offended by your character.
I've heard more than once people say, I got to tell you, I know lawyers like Saul, which is always funny to me because it occurs to me that maybe they mean to say they're like Saul or not me, but all the other guys in this profession.
So one more question. When people see you on the street, people who are fans of Breaking Bad, what do they say to you? Is there a commonly said thing?
Well, they all say, "Better call Saul."
Yeah.
But some of them, and this is so weird, Terry.
Yeah.
And this is like, I think this is because it's so much more famous than anything I've done. It's so much bigger. So this is where we trip into the weird place of sort of a version of success or fame that is so strange. I get this. I got it today on the way into this building. I get this. I'm going to shout this out, so I'm going to back away from the mic.
Okay.
Sal! Okay, so that guy, this has happened more than once. That guy doesn't know my name, only knows me from Breaking Bad, but doesn't know Breaking Bad that well, and has seen it enough to know I play some... I don't look like the character, so he knows it well enough to recognize my face, even though he doesn't know the show that well. That's a weird place to get to. He doesn't know the name of the character, so he hasn't watched the show that closely. But he knows it well enough to recognize my face, even without the hair pieces in and the suit and all that other stuff.
So what do you say in response?
I go, uh-huh.
And then keep walking?
And I keep walking.
And what if somebody really does know the show and they say, "I love you in the show. I love the character
of Saul."
I say,
"Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I'm so lucky to be a part of that show."
Right. Well, I'm so lucky to be able to watch you in it. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you
talking
so
with
much.
Us. It's really been a pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Bob Odenkirk, the star of Better Call Saul, speaking to Terry Gross in 2013. Season 2 of the AMC spinoff of Breaking Bad begins Monday. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the newest superhero movie, Deadpool. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. One thing non-readers of comic books have come to realize is that Marvel has a lot of superhero characters. The latest one to hit the screen is Deadpool. Born Wade Winston Wilson, Deadpool appeared as a villain in early 90s comics before evolving into a rude, fast-talking hero. Now he has his own big-budget movie, starring Ryan Reynolds as the ex-Special Forces soldier turned superheroic mutant. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Marvel Studios might be the most powerful entertainment entity in history, discounting maybe Disney or the Roman Empire's Gladiator franchise. It's up there. And every time I gear up to rant some more about Hollywood throwing its resources into franchises, tentpoles, and now universes at the expense of other kinds of movies, along comes something disarming. Marvel's Jessica Jones, for example, the grown-up, female-centric Netflix series with Kristen Ritter. Or Deadpool, the unprecedented R-rated Marvel romp with dirty sex talk and tons of splatter. Directed by Tim Miller, Deadpool is a send-up of Marvel superhero movies, but in no way a takedown of them. It's meant to enhance the genre, to flatter the audience for being hip enough to get the in-jokes. Ryan Reynolds stars as Wade, who dons a Spider-Man-like costume and takes the nom de mutant Deadpool after being hideously mutilated by the British bad guy, Ajax, played by Ed Skrine. If you're one of those geeks who immediately thinks, didn't Reynolds star in the failed movie of the DC comic The Green Lantern? Screenwriters Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick are way ahead. They serve up Green Lantern barbs from the get-go. Wade then questions his own stature, turning to the camera to say he knows we're thinking, why does this guy get his own movie? In one scene, he's joined by two distinctly unfriendly characters from the X-Men series. No, not from the blockbuster movies. Wade tells us the studio can't afford those A-list actors. Instead, there's a computer-generated, Russian-accented steel colossus called Colossus, voiced by Stefan Kopichik, and a punk girl called Negasonic Teenage Warhead, played by Brianna Hildebrand. She's tweeting at the beginning of the encounter. When Gina Carano, as Ajax's vicious sidekick Angel Dust, leaps into the battle from on high, Wade knows exactly what's coming.
She's gonna do a superhero landing. Wait for it! Woo! Superhero landing!
Yeah, that's really hard on your knees.
Totally impractical. They all do it. You're a lovely lady, but I'm saving myself for Francis. That's why I brought him.
I prefer not to hit a woman, so please play.
I mean, that's why I brought her? Oh, no, finish your tweet. It's not, that's fine. Just give us a second. There you go. Hashtag it. Go get her, Tiger.
Those aren't the best one-liners in Deadpool, but there are great ones. I'd estimate 50% hit, another 30 whiz by inoffensively, and only 20% are stinkers. A hell of a good percentage, given the sheer number of jokes. And Ryan Reynolds knows how to skip along the surface of the role, but when he needs to, bring out the big dramatic guns. He's an underrated actor, although maybe not after this film. There's nothing new about Deadpool's brand of self-conscious humor. In some ways, it resembles the old Hope and Crosby road pictures, with one obvious exception. The action is played straight. Actually, it's lavishly, gratuitously gory, with a gleeful kick. And at one point, the hero is tortured so cruelly for so long, I had to look away. Typically, Wade turns to us and says something along the lines of, this is where it becomes a horror movie, which makes this a have your torture porn and make fun of it too film. It's like the movie has eyes on the audience. There's one in-joke alluding to actors in another Marvel series that had me laughing for a full minute. It anticipated my own response by half a second and patted me on the back for being in sync. Wade has some surprisingly tender and smutty scenes with the love of his life, Vanessa, played by Morena Baccarin, who's appeared in several superhero vehicles and was Brody's wife in the early seasons of Homeland. Wade tells us she's not just another sex object peddled by Hollywood, with a smirk that acknowledges she is. I feel a bit like a shill for recommending Deadpool. One reason it snared me was that its hero functions as a snotty film critic with muscles. The movie is reminiscent of the web series Honest Trailers, which uses film's own selling tools to lampoon them. Deadpool is so on the wavelength of the mainstream audience that it makes you think, this is Marvel's universe, and we're just paying to be in it.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. On Monday's Fresh Air, Narconomics, how the business model of drug cartels compares to that of big box stores and fast food chains. We talk with journalist Tom Wainwright. He interviewed one gang leader who was running his operation from prison.
This guy had a great big tattoo going across his forehead, and he complained about managing his staff. He complained about competition with his rivals.
He has a new book. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Embry Family Foundation, working to expand awareness, explore possibilities, and elevate consciousness through philanthropy and community building. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles. At 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.